December 20th, 1984, Greeley, Colorado. After singing in a choir at a Christmas performance, 12-year-old Jonelle Matthews is dropped off at her family's house by a friend. When Jonelle's father returns home later that evening, he is horrified to discover that Jonelle is missing, and the evidence suggests she was abducted by an intruder. In spite of an extensive search, Jonelle is never found, and investigators fail to uncover any potential suspects in her disappearance. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest mini-sode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today I will be covering a case which was requested by a listener named Steve W., who is a poster at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and has been a supporter of this podcast from day one. He's actually been requesting that I cover this case since the very beginning, and even suggested I cover it back in December. It is the disappearance of a 12-year-old girl named Jonelle Matthews, which took place only a few days before Christmas in 1984. Well, the holiday season has since passed, but I still think this mystery deserves inclusion on this podcast. It's one of those very frustrating cold cases in which it's easy to construct a scenario about what happened, but the only thing we don't know is the identity of the person responsible. About a year ago, an online sleuth suggested Jonelle as a potential match to an unidentified Jane Doe, and since that case is a pretty compelling unsolved mystery in its own right, I'm going to discuss both of them on this minisode. But before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which alternates between our regular full-length episodes and 15 to 20 minute minisodes like this one. We deliver either a new full-length episode or a new minisode every Wednesday. We're currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who's feeling generous and wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. We've actually got 5 new donors this week, so I'm going to read off all your names one by one. Jill, Emily, Natalie, Timothy, and Kathleen. Thank you very much, guys. You are so awesome. So with all that out of the way, let us now examine the unsolved disappearance of Jonelle Matthews. Our story begins in Greeley, Colorado in 1984. Our central figure is 12-year-old Jonelle Matthews, who lives with her parents Jim and Gloria Matthews, and her 16-year-old sister Jennifer. While Jennifer is Jim and Gloria's biological daughter, Jonelle was actually adopted. She was originally born in Santa Barbara, California, and adopted by the Matthewses when she was only 1 month old. Jonelle was part of the choir at Franklin Middle School, and on the evening of Thursday, December 20th, Jonelle and her classmates were going to sing Christmas carols for the residents of a local nursing home. Jonelle's mother was out of town visiting relatives, and her father, who happened to be the principal of a local elementary school, would spend the night watching Jennifer play in a high school basketball game. Anyway, the choir did the performance at the nursing home, and at 8:15 p.m., Jonelle was dropped off at her house by one of her friends and her friend's father. As they did this, they noticed that the garage door was open, even though no one was home. At around 8:30, Jonelle answered the phone and wrote down a message from a female teacher at her father's school, who told Jonelle that she would not be in the following day and that her father would need to find a substitute. But unfortunately, this would be the last time anyone ever heard from Jonelle. About an hour later, Jim and Jennifer Matthews finally arrived home, but were surprised to discover that Jonelle was not there, and there were a lot of things which made them feel uneasy. Both the television and the lights were still on, and a portable heater was running on the floor. Jonelle's shoes were also on the floor, and her stockings and shawl were on the couch. Jim then discovered that the garage door was open, and there were footprints in the snow which led around the back of the house. Even though there were no noticeable signs of a struggle in or outside the house, the evidence suggested that Jonelle had been abducted by an unknown intruder. Jonelle was quickly reported missing. The local police called the FBI for assistance and performed an extensive search of the area, but could find no trace of her. Virtually everyone who knew Jonelle believed that there was no chance she would have run away on her own, though investigators did examine one possibility. Jonelle had always told people that she hoped to meet her birth parents one day, so could she have run off in an attempt to go find them? Well, the circumstances seemed very unlikely, as it just did not make sense for Jonelle to return home on a cold winter night a few days before Christmas, turn on the TV and a portable heater, and then suddenly just take off and leave all her personal possessions behind, including her shoes. On February 9, 1985, the date of what should have been Jonelle's 13th birthday, over 600 volunteers showed up to Greeley to assist in a coordinated search effort for her, but they failed to turn up anything. Jonelle's parents went on a national tour throughout the country to publicize her disappearance, and on March 7th, her name actually got mentioned in a speech about missing children delivered by none other than President Ronald Reagan. Over the years, the police investigated a bunch of promising leads, but always hit a dead end. When Jonelle's disappearance reached its 10-year anniversary, her family finally had her declared legally dead. In 1997, the story took a pretty heartbreaking turn when the Matthewses received a letter from a woman named Terry Vieira Martinez. She happened to be Jonelle's biological mother and had given her child up for adoption because she was only 13 years old when she gave birth to her. Terry was asking if she could make contact with her daughter and had no idea she had gone missing. Well, back in 1984, Terry was living in Los Angeles and police did look at her as a possible suspect in Jonelle's disappearance. They put surveillance on Terry for 6 weeks, but found nothing incriminating, and ultimately decided that she wasn't involved. However, because of adoption privacy laws, investigators could not even tell Terry that Jonelle was missing, as they were obligated not to reveal the child's new identity to her biological mother. Terry was completely unaware that the police had been watching her until she got in touch with the Matthewses over a decade later. In spite of this tragic situation, Jim and Gloria became good friends with Terry, and they both yearned for closure over what happened to Jonelle. The Matthewses eventually moved to the Philippines, and I believe they now live in Costa Rica. But unfortunately, there haven't been any major developments in this case for decades, and the extensive investigation has failed to turn up any strong suspects in Jonelle's disappearance. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I said earlier, this is one of those cases where it seems pretty obvious what happened, but we just don't know who is responsible. Jonelle was likely abducted from inside her home by an intruder, but unfortunately, the identity of this person is a mystery. But what's really strange is the timing of how this took place. If Jonelle was randomly targeted by some predator, then a lot of lucky breaks had to go their way. This took place on a Thursday night after 8:30 p.m., which would be an unusual time to find a 12-year-old girl home alone. While Jonelle was dropped off at 8:15, we know she took a phone message at 8:30, so that's a one-hour window in which the perpetrator could have abducted Jonelle before her father and sister arrived home. That's why it seems probable that Jonelle was abducted by someone she knew. At the very least, this person had to be familiar with her and her family, and had to have advanced knowledge that Jonelle would be home alone that night. Otherwise, what are the odds of a predator selecting a lone victim whose father and sister would happen to be out attending an event, and whose mother would be out of the state? On the surface, you might be inclined to think that the Matthewses might have orchestrated this whole thing, or at the very least knew more than they're telling. But given how hard they worked to generate publicity for Jonelle's disappearance, I'd say that's very, very unlikely. You might also be suspicious about the female teacher who phoned Jonelle and left a message with her, as that person would have known she was alone at the time, and it seems like quite a coincidence that Jonelle disappeared so shortly after this phone call. However, as far as I can tell, this teacher was cleared as a suspect. Since Jonelle performed in a choir that night, another possible theory is that someone at the Christmas concert became fixated on Jonelle and decided to follow her home, where they decided to stage an abduction once they realized she was alone. But the catch here is that the concert took place at a nursing home, so I don't know how likely it is that someone would follow Jonelle home from there. One detail I've always been curious about is how Jonelle's friend and her father noticed that the garage door was open when they dropped her off. I've never been able to find out if the family accidentally left the garage door open when they left the house earlier that day. You might assume that the abductor used the garage to sneak into the house, and that he was already waiting for Jonelle when she came home. However, the phone call from the teacher proves that Jonelle was there at least 15 minutes before she was taken, so I'm not sure if the perpetrator would have been in the house beforehand. Since there were footprints in the snow near the garage, I do think it was used as either an entry or an exit point by an intruder. I have a few unanswered questions, but that's probably because investigators decided to withhold certain pieces of information about the case from the public, which is standard procedure. I originally learned about this case by reading Jonelle Matthews' profile page at the Charlie Project, and there's one passage which has always frustrated me. It reads, "Media reports stated several investigators theorized Jonelle was assaulted inside a residence on the evening of her 1984 disappearance. They believe she may have been murdered by the unknown attacker, and her remains were incinerated to hide the crimes." Okay, so what made them jump to the conclusion that Jonelle's body was incinerated? Well, there's a thread about this case on the Web Sleuths forum, and you can find some posts from about 6 years ago by a poster named Mr. G, who claimed that they knew one of the investigators. According to Mr. G, there was either gasoline or lighter fluid missing from the house, and traces of it were spilled in the garage. And apparently the police thought it might have been taken by the perpetrator in order to incinerate Jonelle's body. Of course, I have no idea if any of that info is true, but it sounds pretty unusual to me. I can't think of any other cases where a victim was abducted from their home, and the perpetrator also decided to steal gasoline from the same location in order to incinerate the victim later on. Since there was only one set of footprints found in the snow outside, the assumption is that the abductor was holding Jonelle's body in their arms as they fled. But would this person also be capable of carrying a can of gasoline with them as well? I don't know, but if the killer did steal gasoline to incinerate Jonelle's body, then that definitely points to her abduction being a calculated, pre-planned crime, and not a spur-of-the-moment thing. Another strange event from this story is when a partial scalp fragment was found at a nearby farm in May of 1985. It was determined not to be Jonelle's because her hair had a reddish tint, and there was hair on the scalp which appeared to be light blonde. But since they didn't have DNA testing at that time, I'm wondering if they used any other methods to conclusively determine that the scalp wasn't Jonelle's. I only ask because if it didn't belong to Jonelle, then who did it belong to? A human scalp fragment is still a pretty unusual thing to find, and I don't know if there were any other victims from the area during this time period whom the scalp could be matched to. Now, one more lead I wanted to mention is a post from the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit I'm always referencing on this podcast. Last year, a poster named Want to Play Ball found some interesting similarities between Jonelle and a Jane Doe. On April 1st, 1990, a young woman stepped out onto the Pacific Coast Highway in Huntington Beach, California, and was struck and killed by a pair of vehicles. Since she carried no identification, the woman could only be classified as an unidentified Jane Doe, and she remains one to this very day. When authorities sent out a public plea for information, a number of people came forward who claimed they had interacted with this woman, and that she said her name was Andrea. Andrea said she was around 25 to 26 years old, but she looked much younger, and investigators believed she might have actually been between 16 and 18 years old. Andrea seemed to give a lot of conflicting details to different witnesses, as she told at least one person she was from Virginia, and another she was from New York. An odd detail which made this case stick out is how Andrea was found wearing a ring made out of human hair. One of the witnesses she interacted with actually saw Andrea cut off a snippet of her own hair and put it on her finger. The consensus seemed to be that Andrea was a transient, but the most compelling clue was how she told one witness that she was adopted and was currently searching for her real family. She also mentioned that her parents were fairly well known, but didn't reveal their identities. Now, a favorite activity among online sleuths is to look at profiles of unidentified decedents at the website The Doe Network and attempt to match them up with profiles of missing persons. Potential matches are often submitted to law enforcement, And while the majority of them don't pan out, there have been cases where the match actually turned out to be correct, and an unidentified John or Jane Doe got their name back again. And there are a few compelling similarities between Joan L. Matthews and the Huntington Beach Jane Doe, aka Andrea. If you look at the composite sketches of Andrea, you can see a resemblance to Jonelle. They both had brown hair and brown eyes. Even though Andrea claimed she was in her mid-20s, investigators believed her actual age was around 18 years old, which would have been Jonelle's age in 1990. Jonelle wore braces when she disappeared, and Andrea showed signs of having prior orthodontics work. They both had each of their ears pierced. Jonelle also had a scar on her chin, and Andrea had what appeared to be visible acne scars on her lower face. But the most compelling similarity is how Andrea claimed she was adopted and searching for her birth parents. Jonelle had always said she hoped to meet her real family someday. One detail which isn't really specified is Andrea's claims that her parents were well known. Was she talking about her birth parents or her adoptive parents? Well, I don't think you could classify Jim and Gloria Matthews as well known. They did garner a lot of exposure in the media following Jonelle's disappearance. All that being said, as compelling as these details may be, I just think the circumstances make it extremely unlikely that Jonelle and Andrea are the same person. If Jonelle was abducted by a predator, then it's very doubtful that she would still be alive in another state 5.5 years later. I guess it's possible that Jonelle could have been kidnapped and put into a sex slavery or prostitution ring, but managed to escape from it sometime afterward. And instead of returning to her adoptive family in Greeley, Jonelle decided to become a transient and went searching for her birth parents instead, before she was killed in an accident in Huntington Beach. But I'd say the odds of this scenario are not great. However, it looks like Jonelle has been submitted to law enforcement as a possible match for the Huntington Beach Jane Doe. And since Jonelle's DNA is on file, at the very least she can be ruled out. The internet has proven to be a useful tool for cases involving unidentified decedents, and even though the Huntington Beach Jane Doe is probably not connected to Jonelle, it's technically still an unsolved case, so I'm happy to give it exposure on this podcast as well. Sadly, I think that Jonelle Matthews' disappearance is just a clear-cut case of a young girl being abducted from her home, probably sexually assaulted, and murdered shortly thereafter, and her remains have simply never been found. I really believe the perpetrator was familiar with Jonelle and her family, and knew she was going to be alone that night. Even though it sounds like law enforcement did a very extensive and thorough investigation, it's possible that the suspect they were looking for just slipped under the radar. So if you have any information about the disappearance of Jonelle Matthews, please contact the Greeley Police Department tip line at 970-350-9600. That's 970-350-9600. I'm also going to be posting a link to the Huntington Beach Jane Doe's profile page at the Doe Network, which has all the necessary contact info for the appropriate authorities if you recognize her or think you might know who she is. But if you just have your own theory about either of these cases, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. I want to thank all my loyal listeners and supporters out there, especially those from the aforementioned Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum. I need to provide a big thank you to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website. So if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm